was there.
Okay.
So, it's April 10th, and this is Judy Hudson. I'm here with Judith Federley, and we're going to talk about the history of women's studies, and in general about women's studies. That is to say the program/department here. So, Judy, tell me a little bit about how you became involved. I mean, you were there right at the beginning, practically.
Well, I came to Albany from teaching at the University of Pennsylvania, and I had gotten involved in feminist political activity at the University of Pennsylvania. And when I came up here, I was attracted to Albany because I felt there was already a feminist community here, and that particularly there were some individuals who would be able to develop a women's studies program, because that was one of the things I was really interested in doing. I didn't get too much into it at the University of Pennsylvania because my last year there I was on leave writing The Resisting Reader, and you know I knew I wasn't going to be tenured at Penn, mm-hmm. so I was trying to do some work and get on my way. So I hadn't done much there, but I came here already committed mm-hmm. To the concept of women's studies and wanting to get very involved in it.
So, then what did you do? What happened?
Well, so when I came here, I came in the fall of 1973, and there was in place the Caucus on Women's Rights at SUNY, CowRS. Which I thought was the most unfortunate acronym for a feminist organization. Hilarious. I can't believe they did something different. But anyway, this caucus was in place, and there was a subcommittee on women's mm-hmm. studies already in place. And so I joined that particular subcommittee, and one of the things that I felt very strongly about was we had to get the administration to sign off on more release time. I believe June had been given one course off to be director of a women's studies program. There was something, and I don't, Joan, I'm sure, filled you in up to this point. There was, I believe Joan and Diva had taught a course on images of women in literature in 1971, and there may have been a few other courses. There was a beginning, mm-hmm. and so there was something enough to call a program, mm-hmm. and there was a person who was directing the program and who'd been given one course out of six off. I mean, it was ridiculous. So I think my own personal agenda for that first year was to find, to get the administration to agree that we could have someone be released from half-time released mm-hmm. To do this job. And I remember meeting with Dave, what's his name?
Martin.
Dave Martin. Yes, who was actually just looking at something on my door yesterday or the day before. I remember that meeting with Dave Martin, and, it was one of those very tense meetings, but mm-hmm. he did agree that we could have a half-time position for mm-hmm. Women's Studies Program Director. I had felt that as I met people and so forth, my own sense was that Joan would make an excellent director, and that the program could move forward with her leadership. And so I put a little pressure on Joan to agree to do this, because even at halftime it was still going to be an overload. It wasn't as difficult a situation as June labored under, but it was still couldn't be close to it, because the sorts of expectations that one would have for somebody, you know, getting part-time release time, then, you know, let's really build this program. Mm-hmm. But anyway, Joan did agree to do it, and from that point on, you know, we started to do a whole lot of things that seemed to me to be the kinds of things you would want to do to create a strong women's studies program. We tried to develop some core courses. We developed the Perspectives on Women course, which I believe then was offered the summer of 74 for Segoria de Sol, offered it during the summer. We did a kind of test run on Perspectives as a core course. We developed Introduction to Feminism, which I taught as a single faculty member the first time, and then developed the current model out of that first course. But I think fall of 76 was the first time that was taught, but we were working on it, you know, and just trying to say, okay, what, you know, what kinds of courses does a women's studies program have to have? What kind of a model do we want for, we had minors at that time, but as we think ahead, what, you know, we would want to have a major, try to get that underway. We would want to, programmatic area, it's not going to come to me, but anyway, we really sat down and tried to think about what, you know, what would be, oh, no, here's what, it, yeah, we have to come up with some model for replacing the director, because right. None of these positions are ones that one could do for much more, really, than 3 years, mm-hmm. and they were completely exhausting positions where you had full-time responsibilities and part-time time. So that was another thing that we tried to work out, you know, what sort of model would we want to use for replacing the director when the director wanted to retire from being the director, and how could we, what kind of model might we come up with that would actually increase our numbers of faculty? And that's when we came up with the model that would involve hiring somebody in conjunction with another department who would then be, in a certain sense, released from tenure track expectations for a 3-year term while they served as director of the Women's Studies program. And then after that 3 years, they would move into full-time work in their department. And that was a very, really wonderful model.
Right.
And I think, let's see, Chris came, let's see, like late 70s, I think she
yeah,
came?
Yeah, I think she came in 78.
Yeah.
79, I'm not sure.
Yeah, 79, 80, somewhere around mm-hmm. in there. Because Joan, I think, served for 5 or 6 years. So she started in the fall of 74. She may have retired in the spring of 80, and Chris may have come in the fall of 80
no,
or the year before.
No, she didn't. She came before then. Because
so maybe she came in the fall of 79.
Maybe, yeah.
And Joan retired in 79. Anyway, mm-hmm. somewhere in there.
Right.
And then, of course, we did that with Iris, and mm-hmm. then, of course, there was, you know, we felt, at that point, we felt that we needed a full-time person in women's studies. That was the next logical move.
Right.
Because we had had struggles in these, you know, you were on the one or more of those search committees, you
right.
know, you remember that we would have these really fabulous candidates, and we would take them to the departments, and the departments would say, no way in hell are we hiring, we're not going to hire this kind of feminist philosopher, mm-hmm. or, whatever. Mm-hmm. And so the desire to have a position that would be totally in women's studies was sort of a next stage. And Judy Romali, kind of put us between a rock and a hard place by saying, sure, I'll give you your full-time woman's studies director, but that's it for this neat mm-hmm. little thing you guys have dreamed up, is to get every 3 years you get a new person in women's studies.
We'll just go on from there.
Yeah, okay. So, anyway.
What about the collective? Talk about the beginnings of the collective, because that's one of the most exciting, I think, parts of the program. Or at least it was at the beginning. We have some mm-hmm. other exciting parts of it
yeah.
now. But.
Well, I taught Introduction to Feminism in the fall of 1976. And this was, this was the 70s, and things were really very, I'm very glad that I lived through the decade of the 1970s. I feel very privileged and very fortunate. It was a very exciting and heady time, and I think it's an example of how lost from history feminism is, that there's so much attention to the 1960s, which from a women's point of view was not a radical mm-hmm. decade, and mm-hmm. the 70s just kind of falls out mm-hmm. of the picture. But from a feminist point of view, the 1970s were truly an amazing period. And we really did believe, I think, that we could change the world, mm-hmm. and there was a great deal of excitement, and we worked constantly. I mean, I remember, 16-hour days were common, because, I mean, not only were those of us who were involved in women's studies, teaching, trying to integrate feminism into our classes, teaching in the women's studies program, but we were and trying then to create, do all the service work to bring a women's studies program into existence. But then we were also trying to make sure that we were represented on various college and university committees, so we were constantly, doing double, triple, mm-hmm. quadruple overtime on committees, and then we were also doing all of this organization and agitation on a whole range of issues mm-hmm. at the university. So there was a political dimension to women's studies that is not there now, mm-hmm. I don't believe. I hope it comes back, and I think mm-hmm. it could come back, because I think in some ways we're going back where we started, and there's as much need now for women's studies to take a strong political stance on this campus around things like affirmative action and the direction of the university mm-hmm. as there was in 1973 when I first came here. So I hope that we'll go back to that, but I mean, we were doing everything. And so in that heady time where we were already overworked, but we really thought it was worth it because we thought we were going to change the world, as part of the sort of long-range plan for the development of women's studies, Joan and I had certainly, I think other people, we had met the women from Buffalo.
Mm-hmm.
And the women from the Buffalo Women's Studies program had this model of teaching a course, I think their course was called Contemporary Issues in Feminism or something like that. But anyway, it was a kind of an introductory course, and they had developed a model that was peer-taught, peer-facilitated, team-taught, but using students. And we had thought, we had been interested in that from a feminist pedagogy point of view, and that is the sense that this model fit in with our feelings about what we were trying to do in the classroom around pedagogy. And that was another whole part of what was happening in the 70s also, was the development of a theory of feminist pedagogy, things like rotating chair, where you try to reduce hierarchies within the classroom, and you try to to create maximal participation, and so you come up with strategies like rotating chair, which really changes the whole nature of the classroom and so on. There was all kinds of things we were trying to do, experiments we were trying to do, and so this particular model fit very well into our thinking about feminist pedagogy. But it also, as Joan and I talked about it, and I'm sure there were others involved in these conversations as well, but I know this was certainly my thinking about it, and one of the reasons why I was very interested in doing a version of this was not that I just was wanting to share the power and the classroom and so forth, but I also wanted to set in motion a structure that was self-perpetuating and potentially exponential in growth. Mm-hmm. And in a certain sense, you know, you do have to remember that there was a certain millennial quality, maybe that's not the right term, but, you know, a sense of truly wanting to convert the world to feminism and a strategizing around that. How could we, given the fact that there were we had very, very few faculty resources. We could not possibly put more than one person once a year in a classroom teaching a course called Introduction to Feminism. We didn't have the faculty to do that. And if we did that, we would have one course once a year that perhaps at most could take in 30 to 35 students, because classes were a little smaller in those days. Well, that's very limited in terms of the numbers of people you can reach. But if you think about the collective model, that has an expansibility that was very attractive. It would be a way of doing feminist education. It was very consonant with our beliefs in feminist pedagogy, but also would allow us to have, with less faculty resources, more courses. And of course the original model was faculty student team teaching. And the team teaching aspect of it was crucial. That is one of the things we were trying to negotiate in this situation, was how do you work across the differences of power between faculty and students? How do you break down hierarchies, which is what we were talking about in those days, and how do you do it in ways that are productive? So the original notion was that faculty and students would do this together, and of course, the faculty would do this as an overload.
Of course.
This was never part of our teaching load, because that was where we were then. That's the kind of thing we did. And with that model, you know, you didn't need to use your very precious faculty resources to do Introduction to Feminism, and yet the model assumed a very intensive faculty involvement. As Joan, I'm sure, would told you, and anyone, I think, who did the collective in the early days, and that would include Mildred Bates, who was here in social welfare and did it in the early period. It was an unbelievable commitment of time and energy. I've never done anything that was so demanding, which is, why, in a certain sense, that part of the model didn't persist, because very few. Well, things changed in the 80s, but then also even in the 70s, there probably weren't all that many people around who really would be willing to put in that kind of time and in a certain sense, make themselves so vulnerable to the kinds of things that students would do in that situation. I don't know if Joan told you any of the stories, but we would often come out of those meetings just like, oh, why are we doing this? You know, as we would try to explain to these students the concept of overload, yeah. and we would say, now, you see, this is part of your regular load, right? Mm-hmm. You see, you're getting your 4 credits for this. Mm-hmm. This is, you know, if you weren't doing this, you'd be doing something else. But for us, this is on top, so why should, you know, why... We get to tell you to do certain things mm-hmm. that we don't have to do. Oh, no. No, no, no. We had to do everything they had to mm-hmm. do and more. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there were some interesting moments there. But that was the idea, and it had that double, you know, it was very, a beautiful model from that. Yeah. In theory, it was beautiful because right. it did feminist pedagogy at the same time that it made it possible for us to spread out mm-hmm. and teach. Mm-hmm. Certainly more than one section, and indeed, in a certain sense, infinitely expandable. So that was really, truly one of the most wonderful experiences of my life. The first semester, I taught the course in the fall. I laid out the model towards the end of the course. I called for volunteers from the class who would be willing to spend the spring semester developing mm-hmm. the team-taught course. And I got a substantial number. I think there's like 15 people in there that wanted to be part mm-hmm. of that. And of those 15 people, only one really turned out to be a deadbeat. Mm-hmm. But then when it came time, in the spring semester, when it came time to say, okay, who wants to actually do this mm-hmm. in the fall, we had 3 people. Anne Ragusa, mm-hmm. who's now Ember Cariana, mm-hmm. Ellen Mindell, and Janice Allen. Mm-hmm. And so it was those 3 students and Joan and myself, all 5 of us taught the first collectively taught course. Mm-hmm. And we had a truly memorable experience. It was really wonderful. And then, you know, kind of went on from there. Then those students became facilitators for the following mm-hmm. spring, and then we got more people to agree to be facilitators, and then the next year, I think Joan went with 1 team, and I went with the 2nd team, mm-hmm. so we had 2 sections. And, you know, then over time, the faculty presence has tended to disappear,
mm-hmm. right.
and it is not really a student faculty collective anymore, I don't think. It's a student collective, and indeed I think there's even tensions between the faculty and students. And what we have now are people who are willing to be instructor of record, mm-hmm. who sit in the classes and, you know, do some supervision and make sure that nothing problematic is occurring. Mm-hmm. But there isn't that genuine, you know, student-faculty thing that I think was a very valuable feature of the first one, but again, it's labor intensive. Most faculty don't want to do it. It's expensive. Mm-hmm. So,
what kind of an experience do you think it is for the students?
Well, depends on. Who's teaching it? It depends on who's taking it.
I guess I'm talking about the students who are teaching.
Oh, for the students who are teaching, I think it's a fabulous experience. I would say 90%. If you could go back and poll all the people who were over the last, let's see, we taught our first section would be in the fall of 1977. I think it's been taught every year mm-hmm. since, so we're talking about almost 20 years mm-hmm. of teaching this course. If you could go back and poll the people who've been involved in the actual classroom implementation of this course, I bet you would get a very high approval rating in the sense that this was a meaningful experience for these students. They get to do things that there's no place else that I'm aware of in their undergraduate education that they get to do. Mm-hmm. They plan the course, they choose the readings, they separate the papers, they run the classes, they meet together as a group, they hash things out, they have the responsibilities of getting the materials prepared. I mean, it puts them in a whole different position, and I think over the years, and I mean in recent years, really since I sort of turned my full-time attention to English, I haven't had too much exposure to it, but certainly for a good 10 years when I was involved in one way or another in the collective, I was always just amazingly impressed with the kinds of the effect that this process had on the students in terms of their self-esteem, their ability to present themselves well in public, their ability to read and think about and present and organize material. The students, you know, the students who were in the collective, by and large, I mean, there's always some real problematic people, or mm-hmm. deadbeats, sure. or some, you know, persons you really wish very much had not ever decided to do this, but the vast majority of students, I think, did a terrific job, and they got an enormous amount out of it, and one of the tests of that was how impressive they were when they would talk about it in public places. So I think from the point of view of the students who participated in the collective and the teaching of the courses, it has been a very successful model. I can't speak quite so easily about what kind of experience it's been for the students who've taken the class mm-hmm. and then not chosen to go on and participate in the implementation of it.
Mm-hmm.
I know the students that I worked with closely, they would all have said this was the most valuable mm-hmm. experience in their undergraduate lives. In fact, I raised this in a meeting with Judy Genshaf yesterday because she was talking about the strategic planning process and how their first identified goals, what they called engaged learning. And I said, well, does this mean that those departments that have been doing active and engaged learning for 20 years are going to get some resources and attention? Because it's true. I mean, supposedly this thing that everybody now thinks is so wonderful is something that feminists have been doing since the early 70s.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to get students actively involved in the construction of knowledge and the presentation of knowledge and in their own learning. And I think it's done it very well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's tremendous difficulties around collective, and a lot of the faculty have a hard time with it. But, and a lot of the students are, I think that they take advantage of it, whatever, but boy, isn't that true of anything? I mean, I think it's a matter of percentages, and in this situation, I think what one gains so outdistances anything that,
mm-hmm.
that is lost.
Mm-hmm. What about some of the other courses, some of the other basic courses? For example, racism, classism, sexism has been one of the core courses almost from the beginning,
mm-hmm.
after
mm-hmm.
the first year or two.
Yeah,
right?
We developed that, the group of us that were working on women's studies, you know, in the first, say, 3 or 4 years
mm-hmm.
After Joan became director. I mean, we developed perspective, then introduction to feminism, then racism, classism, and sexism. We try to think about, you know, what are the core courses
mm-hmm.
that we want our students to have, you know, introduction to Perspectives on Women was really the taking apart of the academic disciplines from
mm-hmm.
a feminist perspective, so that was a really essential course. And Introduction to Feminism is what it said, and
mm-hmm.
Classism, Racism, and Sexism was the introduction to the intersection of various modes
right.
of oppression. So we felt with those three, at the time, that was our focus. I mean, now I would want to say, well, you really can't do women's studies respectively unless you have a course that deals with women's studies in an international perspective,
mm-hmm.
cross-cultural perspective. You really need a course on lesbian perspectives, or you know, queer theory, or lesbian theory, or feminist theory, something like that. We need that also explicitly upfront stated part of our curriculum. So, but at that point in time, that was a fairly radical set of courses to implement.
Mm-hmm.
To say nothing of the pedagogy of the one.
Right.
So, but I never taught. I don't think I ever did racism classes or sexism. But anyway, I don't know too much about it, except mm-hmm. that I know people have has been a difficult course for obvious reasons.
Right.
That you know, it tends to bring in very diverse populations, and then it's easy for them to get polarized
mm-hmm.
around. You know, so each group takes up one of the isms as their particular cause,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and that has made for some very explosive classes in the past.
Mm-hmm.
But it's another one of those courses, you know, when the whole Gen Ed program came up, you know, it's like, well, Women's Studies has been doing what
mm-hmm.
presumably is the goal behind Gen Ed for many, many years.
Mm-hmm.
Will we get any or support or recognition from it?
Right. What about some of the people? Many of the people are still around, but I know that there are people who have kind of gone, or perhaps mm-hmm. gone. For example, you spoke of this woman from social welfare, Mildred
Bates.
Bates, yeah. Who probably had left before I came, because she's not somebody I'm familiar with. I guess what I'm trying to get at are who were the movers and shakers, and you know, including people who are no longer around.
Oh, that's a good question. I'm trying to think. Mildred was in the School of Social Welfare. She was a outspoken feminist faculty member in that department. And I remember very well the incredible struggle we went through to keep her from being fired.
Mm.
But she was basically fired. I mean, she was never even allowed to get to the point of tenure.
Mm-hmm.
They terminated her contract, I believe. Joan may remember this better than I do, but I believe they took advantage of the lack of union protection
mm-hmm.
To terminate her contract. But even so, we did fight very hard around that. Mildred was really wonderful, and she participated in the collective at a very early stage and brought a great deal to that. The group has remained. This can be a strength, I suppose. This can be a problem with the program, but. The group of people that sort of were working on feminist issues when I arrived are still here.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I would include Gloria in that
mm-hmm.
category,
right.
Though she was at Skidmore at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But Dolores Schmidt came the same year I did, and
mm-hmm.
Dolores was the first affirmative action officer.
Mm-hmm.
And she was here for many years, and
mm-hmm.
then moved down to SUNY Central, where she was an invaluable aide. And SUNY Central was still a force.
Yeah.
And they could do something.
Mm-hmm.
But
well, I guess it is surprising that It's been a staple.
Yeah.
When you think about academic departments and how they ebb and flow. I mean, granted, some people stay forever, but they do ebb and flow.
Yeah. I think it has been. As I said, I mean, it has some good things to that and maybe some drawbacks to it, but it's, you know, it is a choice. It certainly is a choice that I had to make at a certain point in my life. Would I have the kind of academic career that is built around moving frequently so that you, presumably, each time you get a better job, better deal, or do you sort of say, well, other things are more important and I'm going to stay here? And certainly the quality of the feminist community in Albany as a place and at the university was a major factor for me in deciding that I would cast my lot here and not take advantage of opportunities to move.
Well, let's move on to students. Can you, I know there are students with whom you still have wonderful relationships with, but who are some of the students who stand out in your mind over the years?
Well, certainly Amber and Alan.
Right.
Although I remember Janice very fondly, too. I don't know whatever happened to Janice, but she was great. But Alan and Amber have continued. They've become lifelong friends. There were some truly extraordinary students in the early days of the program. I can remember, again, you know, classes going on way past the time when they were supposedly over. Evening classes in particular, my graduate classes would go on at 12:30. I don't know, I mean, there certainly are many people, you can't go to a feminist event in Albany without seeing many graduates of our program. I just ran into several people at the celebration for Barbara Smith the other night. And it's just one of the, it's I don't know, Judy, I don't know, it's a weird feeling in a way. I don't know what to say about it.
One of the changes in women's studies that has occurred over the years has been, and in a way it's sad, I think. I'm not supposed to put myself into this, but I do. Is that we started out with a great deal of community involvement, and over the years that has changed as we have evolved and become more formalized and more part of the establishment, I suspect.
Well, I think that reflects the fact that women's studies had its origins in feminism as political action, as women's studies was sort of the academic wing of a larger political movement, so that there were groups, like when I first came in, it was Capital District Women, that had women who, you know, in all different kinds of places. And so, you know, they were doing certain things in various other locations. We were doing things on the campus, but it wasn't like we were somehow different from or separate from. It was just, this was where we happened to work, and so this is the form our political action took. And that, I think, was why it was very exciting to students, because there was that sense of larger context. One of the things, of course, that has happened over time is that there are actually now persons on the job market who have academic credentials in women's studies. It's, you know, it's in a sense the success of women's studies has led to the change that, mm-hmm. that a number of people in our department now think of women's studies more as an academic mm-hmm. discipline and are not comfortable with the notion of women's studies as essentially political action, mm-hmm. academic political action. Mm-hmm. And there that's been a tension in the program, I think, for quite a while. And I do think now the balance has truly shifted so that it's primarily an academic program. Mm-hmm. We do, I think, very little mm-hmm. political action now. In fact, we don't, as I said before, we're not even doing what I think we should be doing in the way of political action on this campus. Mm-hmm. So I don't see women's studies, you know, occupying a powerful political position on the campus. Maybe it will again. I think everything's been in a little bit of disarray because of the change in administration and so forth. But so I hope that maybe we will, you know, return to that place. But, you know, I think, yeah, that's definitely one of the changes. And along with that has come the emphasis of the other notion of community, that is that we as a group form any kind of distinct community. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, obviously there was a time when our women's studies meetings were social events as well.
Yes.
We met in the evening, we met at people's houses, we usually ate quite a bit. We went on for many hours, we had a lot of fun, we got a lot of business done, but the notion that we would gather during a work day in a room on the campus as a meeting would have just, it had been incomprehensible. For many people, they could, you know, there came a certain point when a lot of people resented being asked to meet off campus. They wanted to make women's studies more like other departments. They wanted to function like other departments. You know, is good, is this bad? I mean, there are certain, it says something about the fact that we are trying to get ourselves institutionalized and mm-hmm. accepted as a department, but then there's certain losses with that, mm-hmm. too.
What are some of the other issues that you've seen come and go, some of the other tensions, if you want to talk about them? Some people don't.
I think that's a big one. The tension between those of us who see women's studies as simply a subset of a larger political movement, and those persons who see women's studies primarily as an academic discipline, as a site for making knowledge, you know, all of those things. I think there's a very real, real difference there, and definitely been a source of tension. You know, any program is going to have you know, a lot of personal tension.
Oh, sure. Right.
I think some of the other things that I observe, probably I can't talk about on tape, so I'll be
okay,
happy to
well,
talk to you if you want to
do
it.
No, that's okay.
But,
yeah.
Where
would you like to see women's studies go? Or how do you see it in the next, you know, over the next 10 years?
Well, I like a lot of what we're doing. I still think that women's studies provides a place for active, engaged integrated, meaningful education. That is rare on this campus, and it's rare in other universities. So I think, you know, I think the kind of courses that we're offering, I think the collective for all of its difficulties is still a very powerful, useful part of our program. I think the kind of research that people are doing through IRL and the sort of conferences, I think Francine and Edna, I think there's somebody else, I forget, Iris, you know, putting together this sort of connection with International Women's Studies. It's very, very valuable, wonderful work. The faculty here in Women's Studies, as you know, is incredibly productive. And I definitely think we should have a master's program. We should have had it 10 years ago. It was ready in place 10 years ago. I would like to see women's studies expand. I would like to see us get more resources. I would like to see us be accorded the place that we should be accorded if in fact the university did live up to what it said it valued, which is powerful teaching combined with powerful scholarship, creating an environment in which education is made meaningful to students as university citizens, as humans, in a global context. I mean, I doubt very much there's many other departments on the campus that are so close to delivering what the university says are its goals, and yet we are hardly taken seriously yet as a program. I would like to see that change. I don't know how it's going to change, but I would like to transform. We like to see women's studies go back to being very strong advocate for feminist issues on this campus. Mm-hmm. I would like to see us become politicized again. I would like to see us serving as a group who can effectively move the university in certain directions. I think we're coming into a period when so much of what was gained in the 70s and 80s is going to be eroded. Affirmative action is only one obvious example. And if we don't return to our advocacy, political strategizing, organizing, I think we'll just be creating conditions for our own demise, frankly. But even if that weren't the case, just you know, morally speaking, I think we need to be out there. Mm-hmm. I hope that will start to happen. I think women's studies has to become more international, more global. I think it is the work that the conference Mark was teaching this course. That people generally agree that we need to expand our understanding of feminism and women's studies beyond American ideas of it. I'm not sure that, you know, I think we need to do more around issues of, anti-homophobic activity. I think it's shocking in a way that there is still such closeting of gay feminists, lesbian feminists. National Women's Studies Organization has yet to hold a conference focusing on homophobia. It's had two conferences on racism.
none on homophobia, not one. They don't want to be...
There's the anxiety of being identified as lesbian. So I feel that still very much. I'd like to see that.
Well, it'd be interesting to come back to these comments 10 years from now, see what's happened. It may not be interesting.
I don't know, Judy. I don't want to think about 10 years from now. God, sometimes when I look back and I think about all that work, the hours and hours and hours of work that went into building this program.
But when you think of the students who came out, doesn't that give you some satisfaction?
Yeah, sure.
I'm going to turn it off right now.